From our nation's capital, this is Naps Chat.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter and make believe it came from you.
Hi, this is Bob Levy, the Legislative and Political Director of the National Association of Postal Supervisors, and welcome to this week's edition of Naps Chat. Today, we're going to be talking about the beginning of the second term of the 116th Congress. The second term of any Congress represents the beginning of an election year, because second terms of Congress always occur in even number years. And in even numbered years, there is an election. And in the case of 2020, that election is on Tuesday, November 3rd. So we are preparing right now for helping to elect pro-EAS, pro-NAPS members of Congress. More about that a little bit later in the podcast. But what I do want to talk with you about is our three-legged stool. Now, when I say our three-legged stool, that is the three legs upon which our legislative and political program is based. And that is promoting pro-postal, pro-EAS, pro-NAPS legislation, promoting fair regulation of the United States Postal Service at the Postal Regulatory Commission, and finally, the election of pro-postal, pro-NAPS members of the House and of the Senate. Of course, over the past couple of months, we've been focusing on the calls in some of the press and some of the conservative-leaning think tanks in favor of postal privatization. And that was reflected in a recent LA Times article that does not support privatization, but in fact talks about the popularity of the Postal Service and how that runs afoul of the ideology to privatize it. The LA Times article references this year's Pew Institute survey, which found that over 90% of the American public have a favorable view of the United States Postal Service. As you might recall, the White House proposed privatizing the United States Postal Service. That was reflected in a report released by the White House Office of Management and Budget, as well as certain proposals made within the context of the President's Task Force on the Postal System, which was released over a year ago. The focus of the article was trying to understand why the administration and President Trump have embraced postal privatization. As I said, that 90% of the American public support the Postal Service. If you look at congressional approval rating, which is hovering anywhere from the mid-20s to the high 20s, and the president's approval rating anywhere from the low 40s to the mid-40s, in terms of approval rating, the Postal Service is doing remarkably well. So the question is, why is the president and why is the administration focusing on postal privatization? It would be too simplistic, the article suggests, to say that this is all about a problem between the president of the United States and Mr. Bezos, who is the CEO of Amazon, who is dominating the parcel industry right now. And in fact, as we've talked about in past podcasts, Amazon is developing its own internal delivery network that will compete with UPS, FedEx, and the Postal Service itself for the last mile delivery of Amazon products. But it's more than that. It's fundamental to the view that the market, the capital market, will determine what is the most efficient way of delivering mail and delivering parcel products. It is a view of many of these, including Larry Kudlow, who is one of the president's top economic advisors, that the private sector can do delivery of mail and parcels more efficiently, more effectively than the United States Postal Service. That's plain wrong. And the article in the LA Times and previous articles appear everywhere argue, rightly so, that the private market is incapable of delivering mail in a universal way to the American public, whether they be in rural areas or the postal customers be in inner cities, that the most effective and efficient way of delivering the mail throughout the country in a non-discriminatory, accessible, and affordable way is through the United States Postal Service. And that is the gist of the LA Times article. But more than that, this article comes in the wake of a past article that appeared in Fortune magazine, which suggested, I would suggest inaccurately, that early this year, as early as probably this month, the Postal Service will become privatized. It finds as its basis for that the view of the Board of Governors and the Board of Governors' pursuit of a new Postmaster General who might be more amenable to the administration's view about postal privatization and the government's role in delivering mail. However, that article in Fortune magazine was somewhat alarmist. At the very least, we need to be cognizant of the fact that the Postal Service is in a very, very vulnerable position right now. It's vulnerable for a couple of reasons. Most notably, it's undergoing a transition in leadership. That is, the current Postmaster General, Megan Brennan, announced her retirement, which was to have taken place on January 31st, 2019, around 2 to 3 weeks from now. But she recently announced that her retirement plans have been delayed, and the Board of Governors asked her to delay her retirement, and she has acquiesced in that regard. Nevertheless, you have a situation where there is a extended transition of into new leadership in the Postal Service. At the same time, the Postal Service is litigating a case before the Postal Regulatory Commission with regard to the 10-year look back at the way in which postal rates are determined and calculated. Also, there is renewed attention on Capitol Hill on postal reform legislation, and we're going to talk about that right now. And I'd like to talk about what we view, how the NAPS views postal legislation. NAPS's position on postal legislation is that it has to embrace three core priorities, and I call them the three Ps. Number one, the pre-funding relief. The Postal Service has to be relieved of its pre-funding of future retiree health benefits. That has proven to be injurious, significantly injurious to the Postal Service. Number two, postal legislation has to embrace enhanced pricing flexibility. There needs to be pricing reform in the legislation. And third, there needs to be performance enhancement. That is, that the Postal Service needs to be able to be innovative. Its performance needs to be innovative. Its performance has to continue to be universal. And its performance needs to be accountable. It has to be held accountable for performing at exemplary levels. We've been waiting for a long time for postal reform legislation, and we were at the precipice of having postal reform last Congress. And the evaporation of the postal reform legislation at that time, back in the last Congress, is reminiscent of the lyrics from a song penned by Tim Rice and Andrew Lloyd Webber in a 1982 Broadway show, Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. And if I can have somewhat license to amend the lyrics, a crash of drums, a flash of light, our postal bill flew out of sight, the sections faded into darkness, and we were left alone. Now, I'm not going to sing those words, but that's the gist of it, that there were drums, there was a flash of light, then all of a sudden the postal bill flew out of sight. And as we've referred to in the past, with the passing of former Chairman Elijah Cumming and the transition to the new chairman, Carolyn Maloney, that has sort of delayed the postal reform legislation up until now. I mean, Carolyn Maloney only took over as chairman of the committee a few weeks ago. What also has happened is that the apparent bipartisanship in support of postal reform legislation seems to have evaporated. And that is dispiriting. It's dispiriting to a lot of folks out here who deal with postal issues. However, we do continue to have a number of champions who still believe that postal reform legislation is essential, but more important than essential, is possible. They include, Chairman of the Postal Subcommittee, Jerry Connolly, Congressman Lynch from Massachusetts, and Congressman Brenda Lawrence from Michigan. They are the core of a group of individuals who understand the Postal Service, understand the issues that impact the Postal Service, and will continue to push for postal reform legislation. And we must do so. And we must push for that legislation. And we will do so. They're out in the field and at LTS. Let me come back to the facets and the importance of the core mission of the Postal Service in terms of postal legislation. There have been three House resolutions that we have been promoting co-sponsorship of up until this point of the Congress, in the 116th Congress. House Resolution 23, which mandates, which puts into statute door delivery, that is, that mail delivered to the door. There are currently 257 co-sponsors to that legislation. House Resolution 33, that is against privatization of the United States Postal Service, that currently has 276 co-sponsors. Its Senate companion, Senate Resolution 99, has 53 co-sponsors. And lastly, in terms of the resolutions, House Resolution 54, which is for maintenance of six-day delivery, currently has 291 co-sponsors. The combination of postal privatization, against postal privatization, that is, door delivery, continuation of door delivery, and continuation of six-day delivery sort of encompass a large part of what we know as universal service. So an overwhelming majority of the House and of the Senate are against postal privatization, and a majority, an overwhelming majority of the House would oppose shifting away from door delivery and shifting away from a reduction in the number of delivery days that mail is delivered to one's home. The other legislation that we have been focusing on and concentrating on was House Resolution 2382, which would repeal the requirement that the Postal Service pre-fund retiree health benefits. That legislation currently has 301 co-sponsors. As such, we anticipate the House to take up that bill in short order because it has more co-sponsors than a majority of the House of Representatives. There were, as I said, 435 members of the House. It requires 218 co-sponsors for a bill to be placed on what's known as the consensus calendar, which is a fast track to get a bill onto the floor of the House of Representatives. So we're going to be watching very closely when that legislation is scheduled for a floor vote. There is a Senate companion to H.R. 382, and that is Senate Bill 2965, which was introduced by Senator Daines of Montana and Senator Schatz of Hawaii. That currently only has two co-sponsors, and those co-sponsors are the folks that introduced the legislation. So there is ample opportunity for NAPS members to solicit their United States senators to co-sponsor S-2965. It is important to recognize, however, that the simple enactment, if it were to be enacted, legislation to repeal the prefunding requirement would not be the cure-all for the Postal Service. It would be helpful to the Postal Service, but the Postal Service still needs comprehensive legislative reform in order to address its pricing issues, its issues with regard to innovation, its protection of those items that are core to its universal service obligation. On a separate issue with regard to postal legislation, but separate and apart from comprehensive postal reform, is NAPS's continued attention to educate members of Congress about the problems that are endemic to the way in which EAS-level employees are forced to consult over pay and benefits. The statute that covers the consultative process is in Section 1004 of Title 39 of the U.S. Code. As was demonstrated in the recent pay talks, in which an independent federal conciliation and mediation service fact-finding panel concluded by unanimous vote that the Postal Service was not in compliance with the current statute, 1004 of Title 39. So we are working with Congress to clarify exactly what would make the Postal Service be in compliance, and in fact to clarify particular issues within Title 39 that affect the success of a fair and equitable consultative process. And it includes three areas that we have discussed in the past, which is a timely start to the pay talks. Right now, EAS-level employees are held hostage to the delays that characterize the Postal Service's negotiation with whoever the largest postal employee union is, because Postal Service will not start pay talks with NAPS until after the conclusion of the negotiation process with the largest labor union. And if that large labor union proceeds to go to arbitration, that further delays the beginning of pay talks. So we could be years behind. The result of the final pay talks have lapsed. Secondly, we are seeking a more transparent approach to pay talks, that the Postal Service would be unable to withhold vital data from NAPS at the start of pay talks in order to better prepare us to deal with the Postal Service on equal footing and equal unfair footing. And lastly, to seek a fair and equitable resolution of the conclusion of pay talks and what the deliberations of pay talks. Because right now, if a federal and an independent panel concludes, as the most recent one did, that the Postal Service was not in compliance with current law, that the results of that fact-finding panel would have more teeth to it than simply an advisory opinion to the United States Postal Service. So these are the areas that we're educating Congress about right now. So let's pivot a little bit to the Postal Regulatory Commission, and that is the second sort of facet of our three-legged stool, and that's postal regulation and postal pricing. Right now, as I mentioned, the Postal Regulatory Commission is in deliberations over creating a new rate system for determining what postage is going to be. And the position that NAPS has taken is that the current suffocating consumer price index basis for calculating postal rates is unfair to the United States Postal Service and hampers its ability to continue to provide universal mail service. We think a more adequate consumer price index, or CPI, could be utilized. Right now, what is utilized is what's known as the CPIU, that is the consumer price index for urban consumers. That includes price rises in such items as food products, the cost of automobiles and the cost of daycare and the cost of pharmaceuticals and the cost of other types of consumables. That's inappropriate for the United States Postal Service as the basis for adjustments to its postage. Rather, what we should be looking at, and there does exist an index for this that is maintained by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which calculates all CPI indices, and is what's called the CPI for delivery services. And what the CPI for delivery services looks at are solely the price increases for delivery and message services. And we did a little bit of a calculation here. The Postal Accountability and Enhancement Act was enacted in 2006. So we looked at the inflation, the average inflation rate from 2007 through 2019. First, for the CPIU, the Consumer Price Index for Urban Consumers, and secondly, the CPI for Delivery Services. The annualized average inflation rate for the CPIU over the past 12 years was almost 4%, 3.93%. The CPI for Delivery Services, that is the inflation rate for delivery services, which includes such delivery services as UPS, FedEx, and others, was actually 11%. So the Postal Service was constrained by a CPI which is far less than the price increase for its competitors, which means that our competitors could invest more in its infrastructure, make capital improvements, purchase new vehicles, increase their technology in the Postal Service. Because of its inability to raise rates comparable to its competitors, compounded by the fact that it had the significant obligation to prefund its retirement obligations for health insurance, was really stuck behind the eight ball. So at the Postal Regulatory Commission, the NAPS is taking an active role in promoting the idea that the CPIU is not the appropriate index for determining postage rates. Rather, an index similar to the CPI for delivery services is a fairer basis for determining postal rates. And the last issue I'd like to talk about after the legislation and the regulation is politics. In November, all 435 members of the House of Representatives will be seeking re-election, and 35 of the 100 members of the United States Senate will also be seeking election. In the House of Representatives, of the 435 seats, approximately 90 of those seats are deemed to be competitive. So less than a quarter of the House seats will be competitive on November 3rd. In the Senate, 14 seats are going to be competitive. And because it's a much more manageable list, I'd like to run down the list with you. The competitive seats that are currently held by Democrats include the seat held by Senator Tina Smith of Minnesota, an open seat in New Mexico that had been formerly held by Senator Tom Udall. There is the current Senate seat in Michigan held by the ranking member of that Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee, Gary Peters, and another member of the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee from the state of Alabama, Doug Jones. On the Republican side, the competitive seats include Senator Martha McSally from Arizona, Senator Cory Gardner from Colorado, Senator Susan Collins from Maine. There is an open seat in Kansas that had been held by Senator Pat Roberts, the seat currently held by North Carolina Senator Tom Tillis. Then there is the seat currently held by Senator Sonny Perdue of Georgia, a seat currently held by Kelly Loeffler, the new senator, the newly gubernatorially appointed senator in Georgia. That's Kelly Loeffler. The seat held by Senator Joni Ernst in Iowa. The seat held by the current majority leader of the Senate, Mitch McConnell from Kentucky. And lastly, the Senate seat held by Senator Cindy Hyde-Smith from Mississippi. These are all seats that are deemed to be competitive. That doesn't mean that they are toss-ups. That just means that these are seats that we are looking at to in some way influence the outcome of that election to, A, either convince the candidates to take a more pro-postal position, B, support those candidates or those current senators who support our positions on postal issues, and lastly, to defeat those who have taken a anti-postal, anti-NAPS position on our issues. And we ask for our NAPS members to take an active role in the upcoming election within the confines of the Hatch Act. And I encourage all NAPS members to visit our webpage, or NAPS.org, on the SPAC page. And on that page, you will see what the rules are for Hatch Act. So NAPS encourages its members to participate in a wide variety of political activities to further the legislative interests of active and retired EAS-level postal employees. It's important to note that these activities must be conducted off the clock and outside of government-owned or leased property, because you are participating in the political process as NAPS members and as private citizens. The limited Hatch Act restrictions do not apply to postal retirees or the family members of active postal employees. I encourage all NAPS members who want to participate in the political process to consult with our Hatch Act memorandum, which appears on our webpage on the SPAC pull-down tab. With that, we're preparing, as I said, for a very, very busy 2020. We encourage everyone that can to register for the upcoming leadership training seminar, which will take place in March. Registration is open. Registration is available on our website. With that, I encourage you to tune in next week and have a great weekend.
Write down and write myself a letter and make me